Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thanks for being here with us on the Sunday morning wake-up call, along with our heroine of the day, our superheroine, Professor Carmen Higginbotham. She's the professor and department chair from the McIntyre Department of Art at UVA and the American Art and Culture Studies.
That's about right. Yeah. Yes.
Professor Carmen Higginbotham. Welcome.
Well, thank you so much. It's nice to be here.
Welcome back,
yes,
I should say.
I am back.
We go from Disney, Disney World, Disneyland, to the world of heroes and superheroes in the American culture.
Yes, it's a nice transition, too.
You have some of the coolest, most interesting, exciting classes.
It's about thinking about what's happening today and what people are seeing today and what they're experiencing and having them think a little bit more about what they see and how they understand it.
I mean, you know, I took some really interesting classes that I wanted to take at UVA, but I don't think that this kind of stuff was offered.
Well, I bet you it was. Maybe you did not look hard enough, but
that's also quite possible / probable, but I would also like to go back and look and say that it wasn't.
Okay. I think it's, there's a whole slew of professors now who are seeing a lot of opportunity for teaching with students, big ideas, big concepts that appear in literature, but find their way, or in art, and find their way in popular culture. And superheroes is so big right now. It is so huge as an idea, as a topic, and we're just sort of inundated with films, and our entire academic year, our entire regular year, just full of superhero references. So it seemed a good time.
Yeah, so you're going to be teaching a class on heroes and superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
This coming summer.
Right.
You've done this before. It's not a new, brand new class.
No, it's not. No.
And we talked about it when you were here doing a show on Disney.
Yep.
Last summer, and somehow you decided you had a boring Sunday and you could come in here and talk with me about it.
Well, it's really neat to get to talk about it. Not everybody.
You don't have to pay UVA tuition just to talk about it.
Well, exactly. Well, there is that. But no, it's everywhere right now, and I think that it's just nice to chat with you about it.
Well, I appreciate that, and all the listeners out there can hear about it because I think it is cool. It's all over the American culture,
right?
And not even just the American culture, because all these Marvel movies. I mean, they're global. The dollars that they bring in, the billions of dollars, are global.
Right. They're global behemoths. And not just the Marvel, the DC films that have come out. Aquaman just blew all sorts of records overseas. And it's a pretty amazing phenomenon that we seem to be caught in a moment in which we have a real connection across cultures around these mythic figures that grew in popularity thanks to comic books and mass media. It's really quite stunning.
Well, I won't claim to be a regular must-see every superhero movie, but I did collect comic books as a kid.
Wonderful.
So let's start our conversation. You were kind enough to send me your syllabus from previous classes.
Right.
You're updating it for this coming summer.
Yes. Still working on it.
But I've gone through it and come up with some of my questions based on the reading and visual material.
Right.
Because you asked people to read this article, watch this YouTube, see this clip of movie, et cetera, correct?
Right. So it's a combination. What's great about comic heroes, or at least superheroes, is that they got their start in comic books, but they sort of taken over all areas of media. And so thinking about the ways in which students take in information, where they are usually when they see a superhero, I wanted to mimic that. I wanted to have that experience. So yeah, I have them look at YouTube videos, look at spoofs about heroes from Funny or Die. I have them watch the films. One year I had students, I brought in comics. I went to a local comic bookstore, which I frequent anyway, and got a couple of issues in the sale pile and distributed those out, and students had to do a writing assignment based on the art that was presented in them, just trying to sort of create for them a visual and cultural and conceptual world.
Who's your favorite superhero?
Oh, yeah, that has changed over time. And I think that's what...
How about as a younger versus as an adult professor?
I think when I was younger, I really liked... I loved the X-Men, and the offshoot of that would be the New Mutants. They were a younger group of the X-Men. I was very much into a Canadian group, surprisingly, called Alpha Flight. That's for all the comic book nerds out there. They know Alpha Flight. I liked Spider-Man because he was young. And a teenager and trying to figure out his place in the world.
Yeah.
And that morphs over time. But yeah, those are the ones I spent most of my time with.
Okay. So one of the first things that you have the class doing, or at least the former classes, since this is an older syllabus, you have aesthetic and cultural importance of heroes and superheroes. First thing that came to my mind is, how do you define the difference between a hero versus a superhero?
Right, which is the first thing students want to know, the difference between. I think, surprisingly, there are more similarities than differences. The same value system that we attach to heroism and being a hero and how we define it is very culturally specific. It can be period specific as well. The traits one can exhibit in being a hero, those may shift over time given the historical situation, the social situation. And I think America's definition of heroism is very individualized. I think it is tied to an idea of nation and what one does for one's country. That's always seems to be underpinning a conversation about a hero. And so the American superheroes that arrive from that, they carry over those same ideals. They embody those. But the superhero is fabulous because they are more. They have more. They can do more. Where a kind of ethical or moral strength that's celebrated in a hero, that is amplified into a physical ability. So that you have somebody like Captain America, who's not just strong in his patriotism and the goody two shoes of doing the right thing. He is also physically above human, more than a regular human. And it's that expression that is really significant. So it's really is the celebration of those core ideals transformed into some kind of physical power. And that's obviously what makes them different. The stakes are also higher. Heroes we tend to define after an event has happened, and those who have exhibited some sort of activity that we then can herald as being indicative of values that we have or ideological issues we're invested in. Superheroes, at least as they're presented to us in American culture, whether it's from Superman back in 1938 to more recent offerings we see on the big screen, superheroes often are already fully formed as these extraordinary characters. And then they have to somehow meld into the social and cultural moment. And so that requires us as viewers to extract from them what makes them heroes that matter to us. It requires viewers to also assign values onto them. So there's something really flexible about a superhero, where heroes are fixed. They're locked into a time period. They're locked into an activity that already took place, that they've, you know, risen to the occasion. But a superhero is more of an idea. It's more of a symbol.
Is Superman the first superhero? You said 1938. Is Action Comics number one where Superman is presented? Is he the first superhero?
He's the first one we recognize as being the first major superhero, who would have the longevity to carry one through to the contemporary period. And the superhero in the popular sense. So it's going to begin in comics. And as many of your listeners know, as many as we both know, he would appear on television, many movies, many actors, although Christopher Reeves was still the best, have made their way through trying to be Superman. So, yeah, he's the first. And it's perfect. It makes sense why you need a Superman in 1938. This is a grueling year of the Great Depression. The world is headed to war. You need a figure who can be more. He has to respond in a way that is extraordinary. I always joke with students, you know, the world is in a bad place if you need a superhero. That means the military is not going to cut it. The government can't help you. Faith is not going to help you either. You can't pray for the situation to be better. Your friends are useless. Your family, you know, they're struggling like you are. You need an extraordinary body to step in at that point. And that's why Superman appearing in 38 is perfect. The United States is in crisis, and the world is reaching that point as well.
We are talking about heroes and superheroes with Professor Carmen Higginbotham. She is from UVA's McIntyre Department of Art, and we're going to get it on today, so keep on listening. One of the first parts of the class, you talk about the cultural importance, but the word aesthetic is mm-hmm. in there. So I'm curious, why does what a hero or superhero wears and what they look like, why does that matter?
Well, I believe, and this is what I teach, it matters because most individuals' interactions with a superhero, whether it's the characters actually in the comic or the movie, or as us as viewers, it's through the visual. So we have to see the bulging muscles, right? Even before they commit those amazing feats or acts of strength, we've got to see the sculpted form. That's a representation of just how extraordinary they are, how more that they are. We've got to, so there's a physical presence. There's often an idealization of that form, whether it's Bruce Wayne being super rich, but mentally, you know, definitely needs to go see a therapist, to Captain America, who literally wears the U.S. flag on his body. He is the embodiment of sort of the national symbol with his stars and stripes. And even the Marvel movies sort of poke fun at that at a few times in the series, when he even says, isn't that a bit old fashioned? And a number of folks, I believe it was in the Avengers, I'm tapping into my big geekdom now, and I believe it was Black Widow who said we could use a little old fashioned right now. So, and that's just code for core American values. Yes, what they wear is indicative of their psychological state, how we are supposed to sort of view them, how we are supposed to treat them as gendered beings, how we're supposed to treat them as raced beings. It all matters very much.
One of the things that I've noticed is that when we talk about what they wear, it's also what weapons mm-hmm. what skills they have. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Sure.
Along this aesthetic line, because women, the women superheroes, I noticed they almost never have a gun.
No, they don't. Well, and it depends on where you're getting your female superheroes, but you're right. They don't. They tend not to carry weapons. I mean, I think
they may have weapons, but they don't have guns. I mean, Wonder Woman has
her golden lasso.
Her golden lasso, but she doesn't have a gun.
She doesn't have
but
a gun.
We can identify female superheroes with their weapons of some sort, but they don't have a gun.
Well, there are numbers of male superheroes who don't have guns either. They know how to use them, but they don't. So Captain America actually carries a shield. His body is the weapon.
Well, I didn't mean to imply that they all had guns.
Right, right. But you're less likely to see it on a female
right.
character. Their weapons are, if they have them, I mean, they're extensions of the mythology around them, right? So they're symbolic, definitely, of, for Captain America, he is the shield, basically, that protects America and American value. So that's why he has to have a shield. He's a figure of defense, not offense. And he's also a super soldier, right? So he doesn't lead incursions. Rather, he's that last line of defense. That's how he sees himself. And hence, you have a shield. With figures like Batman, you have gadgets. I wouldn't even say he's got a weapon, right? He's got, whether he's throwing batarangs or he's jumping into his car is a weapon, we can go like that. For the most part, he's kind of a gadget man, and that's what you would expect from a character who has such a splintered psyche. Figures like Wonder Woman, those are items that she gets from her homeland, right, that she brings with her within a contemporary context. And when she ends up, say, for example, in the United States, they're even more extraordinary than when they were at home. The materials that they're made from are indicative of where she's from, and everybody has them, and they're pretty much average for the most part. Not saying the lasso, everybody's got one, but when she gets to the United States, they become extraordinary items. I think they are representative of the individuals, and I think that I think in many ways they're gendered, many ways, but their bodies are the weapon.
Again, our guest today, as we talk about heroes and superheroes in American culture, is Professor Carmen Higginbotham, where she's the department chair as a professor at McIntyre Department of Art. Talk about the role of national identity. You know, we're talking about Americans with Captain America, but we have aliens
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
who are superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
We have gods.
Mm-hmm.
We have Thor,
mm-hmm.
etc. But, you know, are these looked upon differently by a 16-year-old, by a 30-year-old, by a 50-year-old? You know, what is the expectation to see Captain America, to see Thor, to
right.
see... I don't know,
Captain Marvel is the new one.
But starts, not to give away...
be careful.
Yeah. who would be an alien.
Right.
Silver Surfer, as someone who
yep.
is a Marvel comic collector.
Right, right.
But, you know, we have those different types. I'm just curious about how... you know, each is looked upon or presented to us.
Right, right. These are various types of figures who... it's interesting that you make mention of the alien, right? And there's a number of those in comic book culture. I think definitely the comics do and the films do, yeah, they read differently based on audience member. And the takeaway is different because of life experience, definitely. Understanding of things like symbolism and representation. But I think comics and superheroes feel a particular need. and that need varies on where you are in your life. So if you read it as a 16-year-old, you're looking for answers about how to handle maybe possibly your rage, or how to handle the world doesn't seem to make sense, or you're in between states as an adolescent and an adult. That's really different than when you're 30 and you're trying to solidify your place in the world.
All right, let's take a break. Come back, I want to talk about villains.
Okay.
Professor Carmen Higginbotham with us as we talk about heroes and superheroes in the American culture. Hang tight. All right, we're back today talking about heroes and superheroes. When you look at the, we seem to be talking a lot about superheroes.
Right.
Who are some of the heroes that you talk about in the class?
Okay, well, we talk about types of heroes more than have examples of those. So thinking about pictures of heroes, we talk about George Washington, for example, the way he is presented after a series of battles. And then when he first becomes president, we talk about how that crafting of how he has to look, how he has to stand and be costumed, how he ends up on money, those types of things. We talk about...
So it's imagery?
It's imagery in large part, and we talk a little bit about the rhetoric around them, but it's strong. Our conversation is about the strong impact of imagery on our understanding. That's just to get them some breadth in thinking about heroism, that it's not just located within the time period they've been alive, which is, what, like 19 years, and most of them haven't been reading for only for like 16, you know, those years, or 17 or 15 of those years. So it's usually through national heroes. First time I taught the course, we talked about folk heroes like John Henry. How is that different?
Paul Bunyan.
Yeah, Paul Bunyan. I grew up in the Midwest, so Paul Bunyan is, I'm a Minnesotan, Paul Bunyan is the character and his big blue ox. And so we used to talk about those. I pulled back from that a little bit because now there's so many superhero offerings in the last 5 years. We almost can't get through it.
And
all.
Now you have more people sign up for the course than you have room for.
We're starting to. So the idea is that try to keep it at about 17 students.
That's, really?
It's the only way to teach it without, because everything is discussion based.
Ah.
Everything goes on the board. We talk about all of it, so that we can tease through some of the complex ideas. Otherwise, students do what I do when I go to the movies, which is I slunch down in my seat, I eat some popcorn, a little bit of drool drips out the side, and I enjoy myself.
You don't have streaming for this, for people to just watch and listen?
We screen together. All screening is done in class. They can watch it on their own if they want.
No, but I mean, I can't stream this in my living room just to see what's going on in the classroom and enjoy the discussion.
No, oh, you mean stream the class?
Yeah.
No. Because if you're going to watch, you might as well participate. That's what we want.
But I want to hear what everybody else is talking about and hear your conversation and just to... Oh, man, that's what I want. All right, so let's talk about heroes and villains.
Villains, woof.
Why does each hero need a villain?
That villain is their other half. It's the other part of their psyche. It's the thing either that they're afraid most of, or the part of their personality that they run from or sort of suppress, or it is the thing that has caused them to become the hero that they are. You need the villain to explain. You need the supervillain to explain the superhero. That's just critical. So Peter Parker has to have Doc Ock, because Peter Parker and even the Green Goblin, Doc Ock, Peter Parker is a science nut, right? He believes in the power of science. And in the comic books, he actually makes his own webs. And he's this budding, you know, intellectual and potentially professional in the sciences. And then, that's all going to go away when he gets bitten by his science experiment gone wrong. Not his, but the radioactive spider, that is a testament. That's a comment on science run amok and atomic power. And it has, he's fallen victim to that. Green Goblin is about darker impulses, which Peter also must contend with in order to be the superhero he needs to be. And so, of course, he's got to battle that over and over and over again. And we get that in physical form.
Which is how his uncle died.
Which is how his uncle...
Because he can't control his... Right?
His uncle dies in an accident, depending on which line of spider lore you're following. But for the most part, it's an accident. He's being kind of a jerk to his uncle, not in a bad way, but he's pulling away as a teenager needs to do, pulling away from family, trying to figure out what kind of man he is. And so, as we know, teenagers are not always the nicest, or maybe he's just being distant. It depends on, you know, which line. And his uncle dies and he doesn't have a chance to reconcile. He doesn't have a chance to say he's sorry. And so that is, or to tell him he loves him, or to have the kind of ending with his uncle that he wants. And so that's going to haunt him as well. He's a troubled character. Same thing happens with Batman and the Joker. Same thing.
Who are some of the most popular villains? And you mentioned those three. You mentioned Doc Ock and Green Goblin and the Joker.
Well, it depends on popular to who. I mean, and when.
I'm thinking to whom of, and when. Well, that's a good point. So toss out a few names.
Well, I think we like our villains if we really like our... I think we like the villains that pair well with our superheroes. So, I mean, it doesn't get any better than Joker. The Joker. And the Joker, I mean, The Dark Knight Returns, The Killing Joke, Frank Miller's Joker, which then finds its way into the Chris Nolan version of the films. Absolutely exquisite sort of presentation of the Joker.
Is that the Heath Ledger
version?
Yes,
it's the Heath Ledger version, which I heard the new Joker film is going to be great. Joaquin Phoenix is starring in it. I haven't seen the trailer. I've been told by a few of my graduate students I have to see the trailer. I just haven't yet. But up until Heath Ledger, he was kind of this sort of jokester.
The TV version.
The TV version, the Jack Nicholson version, back in the Tim Burton Batman series that was in the late 80s, early 90s. But when Heath Ledger came on the screen, you got a true sense of just how incredibly mentally ill the Joker is, and how that is a violence and a behavior that cannot be stopped. And Batman isn't even equipped to stop him as well. What's great about the supervillain, and I talk about this in the class, is that supervillains really matter in a post 9/11 world as well. And that's one of the frameworks for the course, is that we've seen the uptick in sort of popular understandings of superheroes. I'm not talking the geek fans like me and you who collected well before the Marvel movies. but it's really picked up post 9/11 because we have this sense that we live in a world where, speaking generally as Americans, where there are threats we do not understand, threats that, say, a supervillain could embody that don't listen to necessarily to our understanding of the world or any sort of debate or any sort of compromise or maybe may not share our ideological positions, who are out there and committing acts we don't understand why they are doing that. That's a supervillain. That's exactly what the Joker is. And so we have superheroes because we don't understand our world and what seems to be having an impact on our lives. We have supervillains as representations of those threats, of those dangers that affect us every day. And so supervillains are necessary. That's where we dump all of our fear. That's where we dump all of our concern about the unknown, the random acts of violence that take place.
Again, our guest today is Professor Carmen Higginbotham from UVA's McIntyre Department of Art, where she is the department chair, talking about heroes and superheroes in American culture. Something that, you know, I couldn't think. I was looking through, just getting some material for the show today, and I couldn't think of the word. It took me so long. All I could think of was pow and blam and screech. And I was like, what is that word? I knew that word. What is it? Onomatopoeia.
Oh, yes, yes, and yes.
Do you know, did that exist? Did that word exist before comic books came out?
Sure. And any kind of print culture very often is going to find a way to have words that that give you a sense of noise, of other things that are happening, of activity, of action. I mean, comics are old. Comics and superheroes, you know, are different. And having comic representations, you could go back to print culture all the way back to, oh my gosh, you go back so far.
Go back to Gutenberg.
Well, yeah, basically, you have the 18th century British, like, you know, with Hogarth, you know, refining humor in the print and in the sort of quote unquote cartoon, we'd call like the lithograph or something else today. And it's not quite exactly like the cartoons we see today. Carrying all the way through to the present. So yes, it has existed. Maybe not the ways in which it was exploited by DC and Marvel, but it certainly is powerful to see those things. It really is.
Yeah, when you see a whole
frame of it, just
right.
With a pow.
Right, and all the color that goes with it. I liked the catchphrase, you know, that's been used, Avengers Assemble, you know, the Hulk when he says,
smash.
You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Oh, I used to love that, listening to Bill Bixby say that in the television show.
We talked about Superman for a moment. This looks like a job for Superman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorites, because I collected Fantastic Four. Do you remember this one?
I wasn't a huge Fantastic Four collector.
For the Thing.
It. Oh, it's Hammering Time? No, what is it?
Clobbering Time.
Clobbering Time.
And the catchphrases, but that's something that you need to, I mean, it's almost like any business would create to market itself.
Yes, it's like a tagline. A tagline. And it also helps, you know, readers, whether they're little kids or teenagers or adults. It gives you that sense of nostalgia as an adult thinking back on it. But it lets you know, yes, this is the character that I know and I love, no matter how many times they may travel to Mars or how many times they team up with another team and you have crossovers and they go back to their original and then they, you know, somebody dies and they're resurrected as a new form and all those things that happen. We have expectations of these characters. They are serialized for us over decades across media. And we need those taglines to stay emotionally close to them, to stay connected to them. And we get that little smile when we hear them, and even when movies make fun of them and find a way to insert them into, and we chuckle because we know the source. It's a really fun gesture. But yes, the marketing component, yeah, it's completely necessary. These are businesses, you know, struggling. Comics are, at least, businesses. Yeah. They're struggling. So
let's talk about gender. Let's talk about women in as superheroes for a second, because currently in today's, you know, 2000s, certainly 2010s, the female gender has become strong and powerful, seemingly to me, being a white male. But if you go back to 1960s and 1970s, you don't have Batwoman, you have Batgirl, but you have Catwoman wearing a very slinky, sexy outfit as the villain.
As a villain.
Villainess.
Mm-hmm.
But the superhero is Batgirl.
Mm-hmm.
You have Supergirl.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
I mean, those were, that's quite the difference between the 70s, 60s, 70s, and current times.
Well, you have, we still have Supergirl. I believe she's on television right now on the CW. I think it's still a television, it's a television show. It's called Supergirl. Yeah. They haven't changed the title. However forward-thinking the narrative seemed to be in comics and superhero comics, because there are tons of great zines out there that have nothing to do with superheroes. So I want to keep it with superhero comics and the most popular ones, the ones we're most familiar with. No matter how forward-thinking those narratives seem to be, they are held to the cultural moment in which they appear. In order to be texts that are enjoyable and readable, the cultural framework has to be one that we can relate to. And so if saying or having the title Supergirl makes audiences feel better about gender, if it's, as we recognize it to be, sort of diminishing of all the capabilities that females can do by using girl and not woman, that's because that's what audiences tolerated. There are a lot of superheroes that buck that unfortunately don't make it on the big screen. But there are those who are a female and strong, extremely powerful, both with and without their powers. For some reason, they don't carry over into our contemporary period. And I say some reason like it's a big mystery. It's not a big mystery. You know, we still struggle with female representation and power, whether that female representational power, talking about Disney, is the superhero princess of Elsa from Frozen, right? She's got freezy powers. She's like Iceman, right? She's got the freezy powers. Yet she's agonized the entire film, right? Does not represent a kind of positive female power, because she's, you know, she hides her power. She almost kills people. She runs away. She, you know, she has to be rescued by her own sister. And that's not a very powerful, strong presentation of women with superhuman powers. If we're not going to get it from Disney, you're certainly not going to get it from Marvel and DC. And one of the things that makes superheroes, female superheroes, also different categorically over the years is that these are characters that very often have to demonstrate that they deserve their power. Whether you have Diana on, lack of a better word, Paradise Island, where she has to compete in activities in order to get off the island, in order to be the superhero that she is. To even with Captain Marvel, where she has to undergo training, even though she's got all of this natural power. I'm trying not to give anything away. The woman is crazy powerful, right? But that power is suppressed. If you see the movie, you'll know what I'm talking about with a gadget. She can't reach her full potential. She is tested repeatedly by those around her to control and suppress her power. That's in a film that came out in 2019. That is not a glorious presentation of women having power and using it. It's about controlling it and proving that they need to have it.
You know, my wife, we were talking about this morning, in fact, and she talked about how uncomfortable Batgirl and Catwoman made her,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But how excited she was by the Bionic Woman.
Oh, I loved the Bionic Woman. That was a great show.
You know, just because that made her, you know, that that woman, Bionic Woman, had such full competitive skills and powers.
Right. Well, with Batgirl, it requires you to be subservient to Batman, right? Just the use of girl versus man does not put her in the best light. Plus, she always felt derivative. When you have Batgirl presented against Catwoman, you're choosing between two types of female representation, which are prominent in the history of the Western world, which is innocence versus the vamp, the Madonna and horror categories, right, which are sort of longstanding. Bionic Woman, what was so great is I believe there were even they had crossovers with $6 Million Man,
yep,
and Steve Austin, and they would run side by side, and she would not give any quarter. She would be right there alongside of him. There was something really special about the Bionic Woman. They tried to bring that back. They tried to do a remake, I think, within the last decade or so, and it didn't take.
Yeah.
It didn't take.
Again, our show today on heroes and superheroes in American culture with our guest, Professor Carmen Higginbotham. She's the department chair at the McIntyre Department of Arts. Hang tight. Be right back. All right, back in action here with our own superhero, Professor Carmen Higginbotham. Let's talk about, since we were talking about women, let's talk about Wonder Woman. Mm. That movie, the DC Comics character Wonder Woman,
yes,
that, I think Superman had some of the early Superman movies, and some of the Batman movies are sort of up and down. Some did well, some did not. But the Wonder Woman movie really did a great job in comparison to the majority of the Marvel movies. I think the Marvel movies, a vast number of them were all strong.
Right.
The DC Comics movies were real roller coasters.
Right.
Some good, one or two great, a hefty percentage. I mean, they were just up and down.
Right.
But the Wonder Woman movie seems to have been, I mean, got great sales numbers, got great on, what is it, Rotten Tomatoes.
Right.
I mean, it just got good feedback all over.
Right. It did. It did.
And it was well presented from a show that was brought forth in, what, 1970-something?
The late 70s. I think Linda Carter was like 75, 6 or something like that.
Yeah.
It was the late, yeah.
And here we are again. We're talking about a female character that in 1970 was presented on her own as, I mean, she wasn't subservient to anyone.
No, no. Well, her character really is changed over time, and this isn't one of the older characters. It's coming out of a moment. I mean, as we're having our Superman and our Batman and Captain America merging, there was this idea or this desire to also have a female counterpart. And again, she, in those various, you know, presentations in the comics as she's rolled out, there's some problematic representation of gender by our current standards.
Her outfit.
It really, she's wearing a skirt early on. It's like a mini skirt. And by the time Linda Carter comes around and the television version, I watched it. Absolutely loved it. When I teach it, the one thing that stands out, students always ask, why does she spin? And I said, that's how she changes her clothes. And they said, why does she have to spin? And the students just, it's hilarious because I hardly questioned it. But they're going after, it's like she's some kind of model who is showing off clothes, right? And has to do the turn so they can see her entire outfit. Or she's a dancer who has to pirouette. And Superman, what does he do? He rips off his shirt, right? It's sort of this display of masculinity. But the contemporary film, so good. And bravo, they cracked it with a really amazing, to the DC folks, a great film. I think it's the perfect storm. I think they had great directing. They had perfect casting, where you have a figure who is not meant to represent singularly America like the original Wonder Woman. We get a sense of this person is traveling from another place, kind of like an immigrant, if you will.
Yeah.
And so we can smile at everything being foreign to her, as she doesn't know how to, dress the clothes, wear the clothes as she's in the shop, as they're trying to put fashion on her early on in the movie when she heads to England. But she is freed from all the political baggage of her decisions. She operates on a higher plane. She follows a different moral code that's pure, that's not tainted by war or violence or corrupt politicians or any of that, right? And so that makes it really appealing. And that's what audiences want to see post 2010. She's a strong woman who is capable in every respect. So I think it's perfect timing, perfect casting, and she's fabulous. I hope the next film that they do is good. I hope they don't ruin or render this brand problematic, because I think a lot of people, a lot of women, were pleased by that presentation.
What is Wonder Woman's flaw? And I don't mean the movie, I mean the character.
The character.
Well, all the characters, and I want to get into that next, but, you know, it seems like don't all superheroes have a flaw?
Yeah.
Whether it's Batman, Superman has kryptonite, and there's that sort of flaw, or there's...
Definitely a weakness, right?
Yeah, so, and maybe flaw wasn't the right word, but whether it's a personal flaw of some sort of moral or you know, or personal personality issue or or physical flaw, what is Wonder Woman's?
Well, that's the rub. There recently in the last, I think, 6-7 years in comics, and I started recollecting with my son, who became interested, and so we would go and collect. One of a recent development in the comics is Batman decides that everybody is a threat, and he has to worry about each of the characters, each of the other superheroes. So he starts amassing their flaws, their weaknesses, in case for some reason they go rogue. And he starts creating these little boxes, and he's got them, you know, sort of just in case. So if he has to go after Superman, he's got kryptonite on hand. Wonder Woman's box or bin is empty. He can't figure out what it is about her. I would say, in my observation, in my reading about her, there is a doggedness to her when she feels that she is right. There is an unwillingness to compromise. Now, the comics allow her to be empathetic, and so they suggest that her sense of empathy is, in fact, a compromise. Right. She backs off on, you know, enacting a kind of justice on someone because she feels sorry for them, or she has that kind of. But that's
is
not
that the estrogen.
Well, you could argue that that's, you know, a really heinous sort of presentation, that some sense of humanity isn't allowed to be separate from compromise, and compromise is different. She doesn't, right? She knows what should happen, and she does the activities that she needs to do, and she can learn, of course, but her sense of right is very, very strong. It's almost too pure. And I think as a character, now there are other super fans out there, and they have all of their own theories, and I love them, love them, love them, and I'm not refuting any of them. I'm just, this is just one thing I've noticed about her that could be a problem.
Again, our guest today, Professor Carmen Higginbotham from UVA's McIntyre Department of Art, where she is the department chair. We're discussing heroes and superheroes, where she got a class upcoming this summer, and we're getting a little chat about the former class. And we're helping her prepare for the upcoming summer class.
Definitely.
You've got a section on the problem of heroism. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that you had Spider-Man next to that. Is that because Spider-Man is created as a regular person with everyday problems?
Right.
And not really, you know, an alien god brought down, or a Captain America, a person who's given, you know, super body or something like that?
Yeah, well, so there's the theoretical problem with heroism is that it idealizes and renders into fantasy and fantasy in physical form aspects that we cannot all the time maintain, right? We can have moments of heroism. We can have moments of pure patriotism, moments of bravery, moments of super strength, if you want to call it that, super in quotes. But we can't sustain that. We're humans. And as we spend more and more time with superheroes, we become less and less forgiving of our own humanity. One of the great things, and a lot of people are partial to different kinds of comics. I was always a Marvel kid. Always, always, always.
Me too.
And only more recently did I start pushing a little bit towards DC as someone who's over 40. But when I was younger, it was definitely Marvel. And what I liked about Marvel is they're all trying to live regular lives. You know, the comics spent time on these superheroes' jobs, right? That their superhero status often was their alter ego. That's what you don't get with Wonder Woman from DC and Superman from DC. Their regular life is the superhero. They play act as Clark Kent. They play act at being regular folks. But it doesn't work that way in Marvel. So it was always really great. I could possibly one day be one. Like the life I'm living right now, that happens. But one day something could emerge and I can be something else. They're just regular folks. And that's why I've always liked them. But we have to worry about our own humanity as we spend more time with superheroes. Do we expect heroes to then come save us? Are we always looking off into the distance to somebody else making the hard choices, doing the sacrificial acts? Or is that something we should take on ourselves? And superheroes tell us, even subconsciously, someone else is going to swoop in and save us.
What about, you know, talk about Spider-Man, but you've got troubled superheroes.
Yes.
I mean, I think of Tony Stark, you think of Iron Man, not just Batman. But are these people...
All of the X-Men. That's a whole psychological experiment right there. You could just catalog each individual character.
But are these people
emotional trauma?
Are they being presented as regular people? But is this an example of wrong?
What do you mean
or
wrong?
Or reality? Well, when I'm thinking of Iron Man.
In the movies.
Yeah.
In the movies. Okay.
But is he being presented as somebody who's doing the wrong thing when he's, you know, misbehaving?
Mm-hmm.
Is this just a real person happens to be Iron Man.
I think he's flawed. Tony Stark is so incredibly flawed. We have in the first movie with Robert Downey Jr., him having that epiphany where he decides that he is going to stop, he's going to halt production on the weapons manufacturing, that he is going to pursue this attempt to be Iron Man. But the same things get in his way in this film and the later ones. Ego, his need and desire to be seen as the best. He confesses he's Iron Man. I mean, it's a wonderful turn at the end of the first film, and it makes it really exciting because we never get superheroes who are giving up their secret identity. He's so cocky that no one's going to come after. Sure. And then by the third film, he's like, and this is where I live. And he gets, you know, bombed out of his, by the third film, he's bombed out of his apartment. Not that you couldn't tell it's the big Stark Tower. You knew where he was living. But even that, and there's jokes about that in the Avengers, that he can't stop himself. It's not wrong. I think what those kinds of presentations remind us is that you can't escape who you are even when you become a superhero, when you're granted that status. And those problems still haunt you as you go through life. You don't go through a miraculous change. And that's what, and some, for some people, that's what made Captain America so boring and Superman so boring. These are characters that are so good from the get-go that they're, you know, they become almost saints. There's no place to go narrative-wise with them unless they really have a dark turn. Or they go to Bizarro, you know, another world, and you hit the other Superman, right? Or he gets dunked on the head and he becomes evil for a short period of time. You have to have a complete reframing of something. Really has to happen to them for us to get a complete sense of them. But Tony Stark, in terms of narrative, you can probe his motivations. You can put him in situations that you and I experience and watch him have to navigate them. And he's not always going to make the right choice.
Are you bringing Black Panther into your summer?
I am. It hadn't come out when I had taught it last. So I am. And that's going to be trippy. That's going to be great. I have to figure out how to do it. But because race is always a quiet understudy, actually, that's not true. Race is prominent in every single superhero film, but people often forget that whiteness is race as well. And so when you have representations that are absent brown bodies, that's a commentary on race as well. And so Black Panther is going to be exciting just because of all the buzz and how much money it made. That'll be a film almost, I would imagine, everybody had seen. And then I'll probably compare that to representations like Luke Cage from Netflix,
yeah,
which was quite stunning. That first season was amazing. There's a show on the CW, I believe it's called Black Lightning, the new Into the Spider-Verse.
Where, that was awesome.
Oh, wasn't that amazing? Miles Morales. I own that. I bought that film as soon as it came out. So well done. Totally deserving.
I loved that.
Of its Oscar. Totally deserving. So I'll have to bring that in as well.
Just a couple minutes left here. So I want to ask about, also in the syllabus, you have Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Of course, they're heroes.
Yeah, talk about that.
Well, I have a unit in the class on science. Because for all of these groupings of, you know, the alien who's fully formed hero and the person who, you know, decides I'm a billionaire, I'm going to be a superhero, you've just got the problem of science and science changing people's lives and turning them physically into something else.
Well, we think about Peter Parker getting bit by this. By the spider. But we don't think about Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
We often don't think about the Hulk. We don't spend enough time on the story. Now, the comics do. But popularly, thanks to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, we don't talk about the gamma rays. That was a huge part of the television show with Bo Bixby, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't like me when I get angry, I think is one of the taglines. And then Lou Ferrigno would come out and is really bad makeup, the green, but science. And the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are victims of science who are then made extraordinary and have to decide, you know, they have to face that ethical conundrum of, do I use this for good? Do I use this for evil? Or do I do nothing with it? Do I use it just for my own personal gain? Do I not think about the greater world? And so yeah, we talk about them and we watch an episode of the more recent television show and we talk about their humor and how it tries to be lighthearted. But yeah, it's a great, and it's a team movie as well.
So we know there's a new Avengers movie coming up.
Yes, yes.
Is there a movie or a character that you would like to see? And some of them, maybe there was a bad movie done that you'd like them to redo, so you're welcome to bring that up.
What would I like to see? There's a television show on right now. I'm not loving it, but it's about Cloak and Dagger. It's about these two teenagers who have different powers. I think that could get some big screen treatment. I'm a huge nerd girl, so I would love nerd woman. Excuse me, nerd woman. And I would love to see something rigorous done with our super villains who are female. That's a particular kind of presentation. And I would love to see something done rigorously with maybe poison ivy or I'm not sure. But I think there's a richness there that can be probed.
All right. Thank you to Professor Carmen Higginbotham. She is the department chair and professor at McIntyre Department of Arts at UVA. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I hope you come back because I feel like there's another hour or more of this just to go through what's going on. We'll see you again soon.
Thanks.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Strength is in their fuel. Engineering assistance is from Mike Friend. The Wake-Up Call is produced by Dan Gould. Show archives can be found at SeavillePodcast.com. Be sure and join Rick next Sunday morning for another edition of The Wake-Up Call, only on 94.7 WPVC.